Okay, so we can do history. Fine. So,
Let's go.
We have history twice a week. Not for me.
No, it's not.
Who wants to win Yaakov tonight? Who wants Jewish history? You need to do Ein Yaakov, which is a Agadita, from Bar Baksra, or we can do Jewish history.
How about the history of Ein Yaakov?
Yeah!
You did that already. What?
Agadita.
Listen, it's going to be one tonight and one Wednesday night. We have to...
Wherever Shabby wants.
History of Islam.
Yeah, Shabby, what do you want?
I think that's my last time here in the temple.
What do you want?
My last time too.
I can't. They
fully
hold you.
No, for tonight, what do you like? Jewish history or
Agatha?
Jewish history.
Jewish history.
Agatha.
Jewish history.
Speak, man.
Jewish history.
We don't have all day. Come on, we're going to learn part of the 2 hours.
No, I think on Monday we decided it's going to be Jewish history. Have to be Jewish history. Okay. So last time we were talking about Jewish history, we talked about Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Shmuel, and Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Shmuel had this basic difference of opinion between them how we approach Torah Shemitzav. Do we approach it with one system of hermeneutic principles, meaning how we derive halacha from the Torah, or we approach it with another system of hermeneutic principles, and they are two different systems. Now, it's important to know, sometimes the Gemara find very, very, very strange manners of extracting halachas from the Torah. Right? You darsh an extra vav, you darsh an extra hay, right? All different ways of doing it. But some of them seem pretty strange. So we mentioned, I think, last week already, that really all the halachos which we have came down as a mesorah, as a tradition. But part of the learning of the Tanoim was to pin those traditions back on the Torah itself. So therefore, if they find an allusion to something in the Torah, then they say, oh, this is the source of that thing in the Torah. Sometimes they'll even go further. They'll pin something in the Torah which really they know is not at all connected to that, but they call it an asmachta. An asmachta means something where this is a way in which we can remember this halacha by attaching it to this place in the Torah. So therefore, for example, if I was able to find for you a hint to Purim in the Torah, then that would be an asmachta because Purim didn't exist at the time the Torah was written till for a thousand some odd years. So therefore, that would not be something which I would extract from the Torah. That would be an asmachta. There are many different cases of asmachta, many different cases of drushas, but the Tanoim spent a long time trying to connect everything in the Torah to the halachas to which they're related. Now, at the time Rabbi Akiva, as you know, Rabbi Akiva had, it says, 24,000 students. It actually says 12,000 sets of students. And as we know, they all died between Pesach and Shavuos. And there are all sorts of theories as to what exactly they died of. But the Gemara says the reason they died is Al Shalom Nogu Kavod Zeh B'Zeh. They were not respectful to each other. Meaning that if the people are respectful to each other, then God allows them to survive. Otherwise, God does not allow them to survive. There's precedent for that. The Gemara says in the days of King David, the Jews would go out to war and they would fall in battle. But in the days of Ahab, they would go out to war and they wouldn't fall in battle. And the Gemara says, so really, what's the difference? In the days of David, even though they feared God, there was strife between them. And all sorts of internal battles. In the days of Ahab, even though they served idols, nevertheless, all the Jews got along together. And getting along together is a greater value, Mara seems to suggest, than actually serving God. Okay, so they have here Gemara, which tells us that peace is everything, and therefore if people are not respectful and peaceful with each other, so all sorts of negative things happen.
Where's that Gemara?
Which Gemara?
Gemara that says that?
Maybe, I'd have to find it. It's not hard to find.
It's
well
known.
What? Yeah. By the way, there's a good way to find something. If you go in the back room of the Beis Medrash, on the left, there's a series of three volumes called Michlol HaMa'amarim VaPisgamim, the compendium of statements and sayings, and it's alphabetical order. So if you had a statement like this, which I know begins B'Mei David. So you look under Beis and you find the Made of it, and you find the statement and where you can find the Gemara. It's a very useful tool. Bertrand Russell said, there's a famous secular philosopher, most of knowledge is knowing where to look, where to find things. So this tells you where to find things. Anyway, moving right along. So they all died, and we don't really have any record as to who they were. And they basically are lost from history except for this custom which we have during Spiros HaOmer, between Pesach and Shavuos, to conduct ourselves in certain ways which indicate mourning. Even those rituals, though, did not take effect at the time of the Talmud. Those rituals actually stem from the Middle Ages, when there were massacres in Europe during the time of the First Crusade. Those massacres occurred during the period between Pesach and Shavuos. And since these massacres occurred, and massacres back then, we're talking about a couple hundred people killed, Not talking about what a massacre would be considered today, but at the time it was very significant. A lot of very important Jewish rabbinical figures were lost, and they decided that it's proper to make this a period of mourning. So they tagged it back to that Gemara, which said that the students of Rabbi Akiva died during that time, and we mourn for that, and we mourn for also the massacres which happened during that time. There's a special tefillah which was composed for those massacres during the Middle Ages, which is, who knows? Kinos. What? Kinos is, no, not Kinos, that's true.
On Shabbos,
right?
Right,
right? Avarachamim. Avarachamim, Shochem Ramim, we say just before Musaf on Shabbos, just before Ashrei. So that tefillah was composed in the wake of the First Crusade. It's interesting to note that tefillah was composed in Germany. And in the German minhag is only to say Avarachamim on the Shabbos between Pesach and Shavuos. They don't say it the rest of the year. We say it every Shabbos, they only say it during those weeks, because those are the weeks in which the massacres occur.
That's funny, because it's the way, I mean, the field was not found,
right, because after that, Jews got massacred all parts of the year, so everybody figured, any Shabbos is appropriate for it.
Where was that from?
What?
Where is it?
Right before Musa.
Right before Ashrei on Shabbos after the party.
454.
Sorry, don't say it at all?
No.
That makes sense, because it was made in Germany, so Smarty wouldn't say it. Okay? That makes a lot of sense. So, what Rekiva did is then, he had five students in his later part of his life. And of course, Rabbi Akiva lived to a very old age, the age of 120, and he was killed. But he had five students, which became the primary Tanoim, from which Torah was preserved and Torah was passed on. Now, these five, I forget all the names offhand, but the primary ones among them, Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, and Rabbi Shimon, right? The Rabbi Shimon is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. It's interesting, in the Gemara, in the Mishnah, it's usually called Rabbi Shimon, not Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And I think that's because I heard once, because Bar Yochai was the name they gave to him when they wanted to allude to the fact that he was saying something Kabbalistic or mystical. So when he was, talking and learning, just plain learning, so it was Rabbi Shimon, and he was only Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai when it was something which was a mystical issue.
Aren't the five names listed in the Yavos? I was in
Jochai. The five, no, that's Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai's stones.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, not Rabbi Akiva. Now.
So in the Zohar, he probably appealed to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai.
What?
In the Zohar, he probably appealed to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai.
Yeah. Yes. Now, the these students, each one had a had his own special qualities. Tonight, let's speak about Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir is one of the second most focal Tana after Rabbi Akiva, because Gemara says that all the Mishnayos which are not attributed to any specific Tana, we assume that they were stated by Rabbi Meir, and they went according to Rabbi Akiva. Okay, so Rabbi Meir in the name of Rabbi Akiva. Now Rabbi Meir was had a wife who was one of the most famous women in Jewish history, Bruria. Bruria, it was a great scholar in her own right. In the Tosefta,
she was most beautiful in
the I don't know if she was beautiful. I don't think it's any beautiful.
Jewish.
The
let's assume she was.
The so the Tosefta brings down actual halachos in the name of Bruria that she said, and she said them in the name of her father, who's Rabbi Chanina ben Tragion. So Rabbi Chanina ben Tragion learned with his daughter Gemara, and she obviously became a great sage. Now, the couple of things about Bruria. First of all, she was very sharp. So, for example, one of the Tanoim asked her, you know, what is the road to so and so place? So she said, "Listen," says Al Tarba Sichli Ma'isha. Don't speak too much to women. You should have just said how to so and so place. You know, because you should have abbreviated your conversation. And she made many similar sharp comments. It's recorded in Masechus Brachos. We're getting
there.
You
ruined the
ending. Thanks a lot, John. Yeah, why did you give away the ending?
I wasn't sure.
I think it's got to be stoned. Okay, the
not all of us read the seventh book yet.
Yeah. The Gemara. The Gemara Brachas.
She buys it in six.
The Gemara Brachas said that Bruria had two children who died on Shabbos, and when Rabbi Meir came back once Motzei Shabbos, not Motzei Shabbos, so she said to him after Shabbos, "Listen, what is halacha if somebody gave me two precious stones to safekeep? When the person comes to demand them back, do I have to give them back?" Rabbi Meir said, "Yeah, you have to give them back." And then she showed him their two dead children, and he started crying. And Bruria said, "Well, this is what happened: that Hashem requested back that which He gave us for safekeeping." And Rabbi Meir was comforted by that idea, at least to a certain extent. The Gemara also says there in Brachas, very famous Gemara, it says that Rabbi Meir had some really bad people who lived in his neighborhood, and he wanted to daven that they should be killed. In other words, so get rid of them. And Rabbi Bruria said to him that it says Yitavu Chatoyim in the Oretz v'lo Chotim. It says in Tehillim Kuf Dalet in the 104th Psalm. It says that the sins should be eradicated, not the sinners. So you shouldn't daven for them that they should die. Rather, you should daven for them that they should do tshuva. And the Rebbe Meir changed his tefillah, and he actually davened that they should do tshuva, and I think they did, and everybody lived happily ever after. It's interesting that... It's interesting that there's a difference in the nusach tefillah, which actually brings into question whether we pass it like Rebbe Meir or Bruria. Because in standard Nusach Ashkenaz, it says, V'lamalshinim al tisikva, v'chol harisha kerega tovein. Or slanderers. You should not have no hope, and all the evil should be in a moment eradicated. But the Yekis, the German sitter, says, V'lamalshinim al tisikva, v'chol harishoim kerega yovedu. It says that the slanderers should have no hope, and all the evildoers should be eradicated in a moment. So,
what's the difference?
One is going on evil, and the other is going on evildoers.
That's
in two different versions of Nusach Ashkenaz. What is Spartan saying?
I don't remember the last version. The last version is
Well, I'm not cheating.
The
Yekish
is
like
from
the
Dilagon, yeah?
What?
The
Yekish is
from the
Dilagon.
No, it's not from
the Dilagon.
What?
Where do the Yekish get their tradition from?
Theirs is much more ancient. Those, but theirs precedes the
subjugated evildoers.
What?
Subjugated evildoers.
Or
subjugate?
There's no hope and they all wickedness perish.
No, but that's not
Ashkenaz.
Right.
Okay, that's also going on the people. There's actually, I think it was the Munkacher. The Munkacher was, I'm going forward in history to right before World War II. The Munkacher Rebbe, that was the Minchas Elazar, was a really, really strident, tough guy. And he was really, really, could get really nasty. And somebody once asked him, you know, we should do something to save the German Jews. This is right before the outbreak of World War II. If I hadn't seen this with my own eyes, I wouldn't believe that he actually said this. And he said we should do something to save the German Jews. It's terrible what's going on with Hitler. So the Munkacher said, they deserve it. He said that that's where all the tzaras gave the Jewish people, all the Haskalah, all the reform, they deserve what they're getting, and we don't have to intervene. Shocking. And that's currently they don't tell you in Basic Judaism 101. It's in his tshuva, in his response, in Minchas Elazar.
Where did you live?
Munkacs. Romania.
The good
yeah. Yeah. So I think somebody, if I
recall,
he was Minchas Mechachem. If I recall correctly, you know, by the way, there's a clip of video of him on the internet. This is a famous clip where he's, as his daughter's getting married or something, and they've been, this obviously a movie taken in the 30s. And he talks to them, somebody comes up to them and says, what do you have to say to the Jews in America? And he says, of course, in Yiddish, they should all make sure to keep Shabbos. And you can see he's a very strong-willed person. Anyway, so I think he's the one who said, they asked him, well, what about Bruria? So he said, who says we paskin like Bruria? We paskin like Rabbi Meir. So then, therefore, we are not concerned. Okay, maybe because of Shalom Bais, maybe he didn't want to get into a fight with his wife, you know. So all sorts of ways of understanding. What?
She made a good
draft. Yeah. Obviously, the Pashup shot is that he agreed to his wife, yeah. Your wife told you to do something, you do it too. Don't worry, that's the way it works. Okay, you'll learn this.
Right.
Yeah.
Before.
Before. I highly doubt that he died before 1939. I highly doubt he would have said the same thing had he seen how things developed, you know. That's how you figure they're suffering a little bit, they should suffer. Anyway. I should remind you, once I mentioned, let me mention something else about German Jews. There is a Rokeach. The Rokeach is from the 1300s. The Rokeach says, also a very famous piece, he says, at the time when Ezra Nehemiah went back to Eretz Yisrael, so, you know, they had back then, this is the time of the building of the Second Temple. So just like today, they had a UJA, right? You know, they went around asking people to send donations. Very few Jews actually went to Israel, but people sent money, right? So they sent a message, a mshulach it was called, a messenger to Germany, to the banks of the Rhine, where the very Jews were living, to ask them to make a donation. Now they're probably very rich. So the Jews of Germany are supposed to have sent back a letter which said, you have your Yerushalayim, you have your Jerusalem in Israel, we have our Jerusalem here on the banks of the Rhine, we're doing fine. We don't need to support you. And it said...
He sent it to a phone community?
What?
He sent it to a phone community?
I don't know.
It's the same story when Ezra the scribe came back to Jude. He sent a letter to do the communion worms in Germany.
That's Germany. Right. That's the same story.
It's the same story?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, Ezra Nehemiah, it's the same time. I didn't remember. Maybe I got mixed up. So whatever the case may be, so the Rokeach says, because of this attitude of the Jews of Germany at the time, most tzaras, which befall the Jewish people, originate in Germany. because the land was cursed as a result of that early refusal to participate with their fellow Jews in rebuilding the land of Israel.
Israel?
Yeah.
Israeli Jews in Germany?
Yeah.
How'd they get
there?
Yeah.
Over land, by boat.
Why did they move there?
Business. It was good business. Why did Jews move anywhere? They got dragged to Babel, but once they were there, business was good, and they stayed, right? So coming back to our mayor, so Bria was a tremendous time of Chacham, but there is this quote in the Gemara, and I forget where it is offhand, which says that Noshim Daitam Kalus, women are light-minded. In other words, they're frivolous creatures. So Bruria, in her text of the Gemara, amended that to say, Nashim Daitan Kalos Chutz Mi Bruria. All women are light-headed, except for Bruria.
Where was
it? What?
She amended the text of the
Gemara. Of her Gemara.
Her copy of the Gemara. She just
deleted it. Well, not deleted. She put in
she put like a little craft
there.
Yeah.
How do we know that?
What?
How do we know that? So
the Gemara tells us that. So the
her copy was what? The Mishnah was in the Gemara.
No, there's no Gemara, and it's not a Mishnah either, but whatever, there were all sorts of written Messiahs which existed at the time, right? She wrote it down. So a mayor wanted to prove to her that all women, this is the way Rashi brings down this story, it's a very, very...
This is the only source from Rashi.
Yeah, it's not a Gemara, it's a very tragic story, and if you don't want to believe it, because it's not a Gemara, only Rashi brings it down, you're welcome not to believe it, but it is a Rashi.
That's Rashi.
What?
Rashi knows he had it back then.
Yes, he had the story from the Medrash, some other tradition which we no longer have, which says that that as a result, Rabbi Meir decided to have one of his students seduce Bruria. And this student made it a project over time, and took a long time to wear her down. But finally, he broke through her resistance. You know, Tolstoy wrote a book like this, Anna Karenina. Same idea. Finally broke down her resistance, and then the way it's brought down is that Rabbi Meir, in order that Chas V'Shalom she shouldn't be technically over. Transgressed the sin of adultery. So the mayor himself came in disguise as a student, had relations with her, but when she realized what she did, she committed suicide.
So she didn't actually cheat on him?
Wow.
Yeah, but she meant to cheat on him.
No, but yeah, that's
the
same
thing.
Did she cheat on your husband? Yeah,
that's a
better. Yeah, cheating on your husband's affair, right? What?
Freud would have had
a cheating on
your husband.
Can we have
relations with this, with what she thought was the student who was trying to seduce her that whole time.
To
prove to her that all women, not Daitan Kalos.
Was he happy?
Even Bruria, no. And they were not happy afterwards.
I think it's not a good
book,
because men would much easier.
What?
Yeah, I would agree. Saying that men are easier to be seduced than women.
Yeah, I don't think that's proof of Titus.
A man would jump at an opportunity for the rats.
Well, what am I going to tell you?
Well, those are natural wives anyway.
The question is, that man, this guy is supposed to be a tzaddik. Why would he make his wife sin so much?
Because the truth is more important.
He wanted to prove a point that tomorrow when we have a Messiah about something.
Even if she doesn't do an Avera.
It's a very strange story, and again, as I say, it's only in the Rashi. So yeah, maybe it's not. Maybe it's only one Messiah and not the actual thing of what happened to Bruria. But as a result. As a result of this episode, first of all, one other thing is that I'm sure that not everybody holds this to be true, because people do name their daughters Bruria.
Yeah.
to this very day. And it seemed very unlikely that people would name their daughters Bruria if they believed she can't be him. It was a biggie. And it led to a bitter end. So yeah, I assume that people still hold that she was a... We don't know the names.
Is it Rabbi Yishmael?
I don't know the names.
What?
I don't know. I don't think we know the names. Anyway, so Rabbi Meir, as a result, ended his days in Turkey. In other words, he was so embarrassed of this incident, or some other reason, if you don't believe this incident took place, and he ended up in Asia Minor.
Is it true that he's buried standing up?
No. We don't actually know where he is. We don't know actually with certainty, even though there's a kever, which is supposed to be his kever, he died in Turkey. So, and he was buried there originally, which is where they brought his bones up to Eretz Yisrael afterwards.
Did he die before Rabbi Akiva or after?
No, after Rabbi Akiva. Okay. Now,
the same person as Rabbi Meir Baranus?
No. It's a good matter of dispute. It's not sure. It's not clear. The assumption is that yes, but it's not clear. Okay? That's because he died in Turkey and there's a kever Rabbi Meir Baranus. The question is whether this is a... But it's Feria, no?
Yeah.
Now, I want to go backwards in time a little bit, which is when Rabbi Meir was still, and Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Huda, and I forgot the two others, as I said, were still relatively young. Rabbi Akiva was killed. Now, why was Rabbi Akiva killed? So we really have to talk about that in a bit of detail, but I'm going to come back to that in a couple of minutes. Rabbi Akiva was killed because of Bar Kokhba, and we'll come back to that. But after Rabbi Akiva was killed, there was a big problem, because these five students had not yet received true smicha. Now, what is true smicha? Nowadays, people get a piece of paper which tells them that they're a rabbi, right? It says, what? There's real smicha, which is called yore yore. There's an additional smicha for sitting in court cases, which some people get, which is called yodin yodin. And then there's a fake smicha, which they give people who need to be called rabbi, even though they have no clue how to be a rabbi, such as teachers and schools and stuff like that. And those are called called Rav Umanig. Those give smicha to be a rabbi and a leader.
Well, what do you have, brother?
Yori Yori.
How can you get the gong?
There's no official ceremony granting you that title.
There's no paper?
How do you get the difference? What in Israel, I know they have like the official Rabban. Look, you sit there and you're like,
pass.
You that in North America too? Like,
well, in North America, usually yeshivas give smicha.
Well,
Yon is kind of, outside of Eretz Yisrael, it's kind of random. Some yeshivas just give it as part of their smicha. I have to tell you something else about it. Chavetz Chaim, right? In Baltimore, they used to give Yon when you finish shas, which I would have qualified, but I was not Baltimore at the time. First time? Yeah. And right? So,
wow.
Well, you know, culture cool, so what's the problem?
What if you do it art school style?
I know, good question.
No, it's not a race, man. He's to his own.
I have to tell
you that in the conservative smicha, the conservative, they only give JTS. Only gives Rav Umanig, because the early conservative rabbinate, who were scholars, knew that their American students were a bunch of dumbbells, and they don't deserve to get real smicha, so they gave him Rav Umanig, and it's considered a prestigious additional step in the conservative rabbinate if you actually got a private yore yore from one of the conservative rabbis who had it. The conservative rabbis, they give it to each other, you know.
What do you think of JTS like 20, 30 years ago?
Sorry?
What do you think of JTS like at its beginning?
It was an institute, very high academic institute, which is totally bereft of Yerushalayim. What did you do?
Jewish
what? Of course.
What is it?
Yeah. They're a bunch of litvaks.
Yeah, it's for...
Not necessarily mean that Yerushalayim.
Yeah, but they were... that was their brand of Lithuanian. Anyway, but if you go to HUC, which is the Reform Seminary in Cincinnati and other locations, they give Yore, Yodin, Yodin.
Oh,
okay.
Just
really happy. Their smicha, they give Yore,
Yodin. Wait, hold on, all the rabbis?
No.
That's the
name of the Yari, Yari,
Yari, Yari, Yari, Yari. And I said, I heard that you only have to learn one daf tomorrow. It's a pass. She said, no, it's not true. Then last one, I'm like, what did you learn? She's like, I can't remember. It was like a year ago.
Well, technically speaking, you know, in order to get real smicha, you don't have no Gemara either. You have no Shulchan
Aruch.
Yeah, you should know anything.
Of course. Nevertheless, they give Yor Yodin Yodin. Which is very amusing because since they don't believe in halacha, I'm not sure what they're actually supposed to pass it. But, okay. The,
What does it mean to give Yor Yodin? So I'm giving the right to Yor Yodin.
So I can call my parents rabbis, a fake rabbi now.
What?
So my parents are conservative, so I can call them fake rabbis because Rav Monheg isn't really a smicha.
If you really want to, I'm not sure. Yes.
Do they have smicha?
GTS. No, they Rav Monheg. He just said it was fake.
But they do.
Yeah. Okay. No, not my parents. No. My parents is rabbi.
Yeah.
My mother can't even say halacha, right?
I don't know.
Halacha.
The
that's the history.
Yeah. So it happened that after the king was killed, they didn't have the real smicha. The real smicha was only given in Eretz Yisrael, and it was given by somebody who had smicha before. Now this smicha authorized the person who had it to judge certain court cases which we can no longer judge. For example, a court case to flog somebody, to whip him, or a court case to impose certain kinds of fines, and a court case with capital crimes. Only if somebody with true smicha could actually do that. Otherwise, you can't do those things. Other things, Kiddush HaKodesh, to make calendar, only somebody with true smicha can do. So there was a danger after the Bar Kokhba rebellion, Rabbi Kiva was killed, the other great sages were killed. The Romans outlawed the practice of giving smicha.
What was it, like a ceremony? I mean, like,
what?
How do they know? You come to
there was
out,
a ceremony.
Like,
yeah.
It has to be a ceremony.
Yeah. It seems that way, yeah. It seems that way.
It was news.
Rabbi Kiva wasn't the only person. No,
what?
Rabbi Kiva wasn't the only
No, but the Romans banned it. They banned giving smicha. So they banned the procedure. And they said any city in which the smicha was given is going to be destroyed. What?
No, it has to be a ceremony. You don't understand. It has to be. Okay.
Yeah, I know exactly what went down at the ceremony, but they had to have a ceremony in order to do it. So the Gemara says that Rabbi Yehuda ben Brava, who was one of the elders, maybe he was one of the original Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva, maybe he was the Talmidim of somebody else, he still had the real smicha. He took these five great students, Rabbi Akiva, he took them to a point which was equidistant between two cities. That in the field. So nobody could say, well, this city should be destroyed, that city should be destroyed, because it was equidistant from the two cities. And he gave them smicha there, however it worked. And then the Romans heard about this and they were coming and pursuing. And Rabbi Ben Bava said, you guys run away, I'll stand here and delay them. And it says the Romans shot him, I think, with some 300 arrows until he became like a sieve. They were from teachers. Well, it was an academic institution. It wasn't
Yeshiva. I had some very right-wing rabbis. Yeshiva wasn't 30 years ago.
30? The last Orthodox rabbi graduated from JDS in the 30s.
Rabbi Herbert Goldstein.
There's some rabbis in the Tshuva, but they weren't from when they went to JDS. After the 30s, it didn't happen. Yeah.
What with the Rabbi Yosef Karo? He wanted to read.
So this smicha, now on top of smicha, the smicha continued in Eretz Yisrael until the third generation of the Amoraim. The third generation, several generations after the generation we're talking about, five or six generations further. In Babel was never given. There was an occasion when Rav, the greatest student of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, went down to Babel to do Kiruv in Babel and set up a yeshiva, and Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi did not give him the real smicha. And that's why he's called Rav and not Rabbi. In the Gemara or Mishnah, wherever it says Rabbi, that person has real smicha. Where it says Rav, he didn't have real smicha. So what did he get? He got Yore Yore, Yadin Yadin, and a third thing which we no longer have called Yatir B'choros Yatir, which means that if there's halacha, the firstborn animal of a cow or sheep is holy and it has to be brought as a sacrifice unless it gets a blemish, right? It says Rav lived 18 months among the shepherds to learn all the halachos of blemishes. Very complicated. So that was a special third part of the smicha. Yatir B'choros Yatir. But he didn't get, that's why he's called Rav, because he was just a Rav, not a Rabbi. And came a time of Hillel, the second Hillel, but that was the time of the Roman persecutions in the early 400s. That's when smicha died out completely. In the 1500s, there was a koy in Tzfas, the Marie Bey Rav, who was the Rebbe of Rabbi Yosef Karo, decided the time had come to renew the smicha. How do you renew the smicha? Instead, the Rambam says that if all the sages in the land of Israel get together and decide to give smicha to one person, that person will become a samuch, and he can give smicha to other people.
Wait, so who was the rabbi between? Between 1500 and 400,
Every rabbanim, but not with the real smicha. Like today, we have rabbanim who don't have the real smicha.
Who decided who's the real rabbi?
What?
Who decided who's the real rabbi?
I'm coming back. By the way, I should mention that for many years, in the Sephardic lands, they didn't use the title Rav at all. They used the title Chacham. And a Chacham was someone who had accomplished what we call Yore Yore Yadin Yadin today, even though it resembles what Rav got. It's not all the same thing. You know, Rav was great in Talmud Chacham his generation, and now every Tom, Dick, and Harry can get Yore Yore Yadin Yadin. Right? So therefore, the Sephardim just didn't use the title for many years. The Rivash says, this smicha which the Ashkenazim give, it's ridiculous, absurd, who ever heard of such a thing? The Sephardim just ignored it. What the Rivash calls it is smichas morenu. Because I guess before they, Yadin, they used to say, this guy can be called morenu, and Rivash didn't like it.
I think the Yamas, what?
Because he went to Chutzlaretz. He didn't want to give some Chutzlaretz real smicha.
Was there online smicha back then?
That is correct. One of the reasons why they wanted to renew smicha was because that was a time when a lot of the Jews who had converted in Spain at the time of the Inquisition were fleeing and coming to the land of Israel, and they had transgressed sins for which the penalty is kares, divine punishment, and we know that the punishment of kares, it can be mitigated if that individual receives lashes in this world. So it doesn't get the divine punishment. So they want to give lashes, but they're going to give lashes until they had a proper record made up of smuchim. So the Marie Bey Rav, who's the Rebbe of the Beis Yosef, got together. Now, this is a mystery why he did this. He got together all the rabbis of Tzfas, but he didn't invite the rabbis of Yerushalayim. So he got together all the rabbis in Tzfas, and they took several of the rabbonim in Tzfas, among them Rabbi Yosef Karo, and the Al-Sheikh, and the Rivaz, David Ben Zimra, who later became a great posting in Egypt, the Rivaz, and they gave them real, they gave them smicha, and they said, now they're real smuchim. But the Rosh Hashiva in Yerushalayim, the Marabach, Rabbi Levi Ben Chaviv, he was very upset about this. he said, what kind of chutzpah is that? That you guys just assumed you're all the sages in the land of Israel? What about us down here? You didn't consult us? They should have made a convention. And he said, for some reason, after the fact, I don't remember why, he had a reason, for some reason he did not agree now to go along, because the Tribune said, okay, fine, sorry. Now we'll join them with us, but he would not go along, and he refused to accept this meeting, refused to participate in giving it again. So therefore the whole thing wasn't valid and basically died out the entire concept. But in theory, the Rambam says that this is possible, but the Rambam says, and this won't happen until Mashiach comes. So the normal understanding of the Rambam is, in theory it could happen before Mashiach comes, but in practice, you're not going to get all the sages in the land of Israel to agree on any one guy that he should be to get the real smicha until Mashiach comes. So therefore, it's not going to happen. Now, it happens to be that now, in the past few years, Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz and a couple of other rabbis organized what they call the Sanhedrin. Anybody hear about that?
Yeah.
Right. So I don't know what's going through their minds. I'm not sure exactly what they're thinking. So you can't have a real Sanhedrin until you have real smicha. And you can't have real smicha until everybody in Israel decides to give them smicha, and that ain't going to happen. So I'm not sure exactly what's cooking inside them. Yeah.
The reason they abolished the Sanhedrin in the first place is because there were so many sinners that they didn't want to kill everybody. So the rabbi decided to break all this and then have Sanhedrin, we're going to remove it completely. So what if
the truth?
Yeah.
So if they're going to make a Sanhedrin right now, if they're talking about, I don't know, 75% of Israel, they want to put him to what? To death punishment?
No, but you can only put somebody to death if you're sitting in if the Sanhedrin is in its proper location, the main Sanhedrin, proper location in the Beis HaMikdash. So even though you can have a Sanhedrin outside the Beis HaMikdash, they don't have capital authority, so they wouldn't have to put people to death. Yeah.
How do you define who the rabbis are would have to agree to pick this?
That's another thing which they'll be able to agree on. Who are the rabbis who have to agree? You know, it's and that's why it seems like, although in theory that such a thing could work, in practice, it's not going to happen.
Because you had smicha, can you give smicha to other people? How does that
yeah.
Work? So then some guy who just, some 20-year-old just got smicha, or whatever, 28-year-old just got smicha, gives smicha, and, you know, Rebel Yashu can give smicha, there's no difference. So how does it work?
Like, well,
how do they decide what
the consumer are? Should beware. In other words, the person who takes you as a rabbi should beware and inquire where you got your smicha from. That's generally true. They say, and in the old days, by the way, a lot of rabbanim give smicha to not such accomplished scholars because they figure, oh, it encourages them. Now that they're rabbis, maybe they'll begin to learn something. You know, because they have to, on the job training. They say, Ramesh Feinstein used to give lots and lots of smichas, and they say that on the back of the smicha it said, not to be used for paskening. In case of question, call. Moshe Feinstein's phone number on it. So, anybody can give smicha, but buyer beware.
The person is very well versed in the Talmud and Halakha and Shulchan Aruch. He knows it. He never wants to take the exam. He's not the rabbi.
So technically speaking, the only reason why you would need smicha is if you are a Talmud of a certain Rav, and you want a paskin in his city. And the old days, they took that very seriously. In other words, if you lived in a certain city, you were not allowed to, and there was a Rav in the city, or you were a Talmid of a certain Rav, you were not allowed to paskin until you got permission from him. So therefore, smicha was permission to paskin. That's really what it was. But nowadays, in fact, yes, if you're not, if you're an accomplished scholar, theoretically, absolutely, you can paskin on your own, regardless of whether you have the smicha or don't have the smicha.
So this is just a piece of paper. What if you lose it? I mean, like, the certificate, what if you lose it? And you have a copy of it?
If you lose it, you lose it. So what? That problem is if you want to get a job, usually shuls want you to prove that you have smicha. So, but, you know, you're right. If you lose it, it's not if, by the Christians, the priest or the minister has the right to minister certain sacraments, which the layperson does not. But by Judaism, and I think also by Islam, where, you know, imam is the same word as chacham. So there is no concept of the rabbi having more rights to administer sacraments than the layman. So therefore, there is no qualitative difference between having smicha, not having smicha, but I can tell you, having smicha makes your parents happy. So therefore, it's very worthwhile. Yeah.
So, if you go for the smicha test, you say, like, I want to get your smicha and use your different test, or I want to get...
Your smicha is on a defined body of knowledge. It's on Hilchos Basar B'chola, Hilchos Tarovez, and Melicha, or some people, since Melicha is so rare nowadays, that the Rav has a Shalos Hilchos Melicha, some people substitute Shabbos, or Nida, or Erevin, or something like that. Now, in Eretz Yisrael, where the smicha are, to smicha taken much more seriously, the Rabbanut has written tests, and to get the basic Rabbanut smicha, you have to know much, much more than regular, than the minimum which we're discussing. Then the Rabbanut has levels. There's authority, which is called kosher, to be a Rav Shkuna, the Rav of a neighborhood, a Rav Ir, the Rav of the city, to be a Dayan. So those entail more tests.
They have age levels.
What?
They have age levels.
For Dayanim. I don't think for Rabbanim. For Dayanim they do. I think you have to be over 30 to be a Dayan.
Well,
that's going to be 5 minutes. Why don't we have to ask Torah? Nice try, though.
So anybody can come take an exam, like, let's say I learn Shulchan Aruch, no, and I can just go and say, give me the exam.
You do it 3 times a year.
Yeah.
Well, Elsa, is it? And I guess if I read Shulchan Aruch properly,
yeah,
and I should get my exam. Then also Joseph to write.
No, you have to write. I took the rabbi, but it's not a hard test. Not a hard test.
I took
the test 20 some odd years ago.
Are there any, like, rabbinical frats that have all the answers?
Yeah. They just ask you, tell us all your knowledge about a certain topic, which is, they're not cases. It's not cases. Well, this hamburger got dipped in milk, and then you fried it up. No, they don't give cases. No, it's not about that.
True or false?
Yeah. Biggest
question.
That's in Israel.
Yes, in Israel.
Yeah. They also, you have to be in Israel. Take this many years ago. When I took the first, I only took the first test because I was in Israel at the time. But later, I wanted to take other tests in order to get a full Rabbanut Smicha, but I was in Chutz Laaretz and they wrote me a letter saying that since there is no precedent, we cannot give you a test outside Israel. And therefore,
couldn't
finish it.
Why? Can you just come to the test?
It's not realistic. It's very expensive.
Yeah.
So the question is whether that's worth it. Anyway, so getting back to our topic. So that's how the Smicha continued for several generations. Now, the Bar Kokhba Rebellion occurred in the 130s. Before the Bar Kokhba Rebellion, there was a period of pretty hopeful period. Hadrian, who was the emperor during the Bar Kokhba Rebellion period, had even explored with the Jews the possibility of rebuilding the Beis HaMikdash. In other words, there was some talk that the Beis HaMikdash would be rebuilt. And the rabbis were eager to pursue that. In fact, there was an article written in Jewish Action magazine several years ago by a fellow who's an expert on the topic, I forgot his name, and he claimed that actually a third temple was built. I don't...
We all forgot,
right. But that there was a third temple which was built at the time, very short-lived, and that, that it was built at the time of Hadrian. But I also want to mention there was one very wicked emperor between the time of the structure of Beis HaMikdash and the time of Hadrian. His name was something with a D, I forget it offhand. Diocletus or something like that. So he went...
The brother of Titus?
No, I think it was later than that. Okay. But he went and he destroyed Alexandria in Egypt. Egypt was... Alexandria was one of the greatest Jewish communities in the diaspora. And the Gemara in Sukkah says they had a very elaborate elaborate shul with which was so large that they had to use flags in order to let people in the back know when to say Amen. Because they couldn't hear what was happening in the front. And everybody had their own section, the silversmiths by themselves, the blacksmiths by themselves, coppers by themselves, and anybody who came to town would go to people of his trade, that section of shul, and join them. And they had 70 chairs made of gold, corresponding to the Sanhedrin, and lots of other good stuff. And all this was destroyed because they were not supposed to make such a major edifice and ostentatious thing in Chutz La'aretz, and the Jews were annihilated. That was several years before the revolt of the Bar Kokhba incident. Bar Kokhba himself. Bar Kokhba, I mentioned this last time, his real name is Bar Koziba. Shimon Bar Koziba. And Koziba was changed by his followers to Bar Kokhba because Kochav is a star, and, you know, they saw him as being, you know, a star. The rabbis, after he went bad, explained Bar Ben Koziba, the Hebrew word for something which is false, is Kazav. So that he was Ben Koziba, he was Kozev. He was false, in that people thought he would be a savior, and he turned out not to be a savior. Rabbi Akiva thought he was the savior. Akiva thought he was Mashiach. After the Jews had actually wreaked havoc with the Romans and successfully set up their own government, the Romans closed in and they came and laid siege to the last great fortress of Beitar. Beitar is actually a stop on the Yerushalayim Tel Aviv train. There's a little Arab town called Batir, which is, I don't know if it stops there now, but that is Beitar. For some reason, the Israelis have never excavated Beitar. You know, unlike Masada and other places where they did archaeological expeditions, Beitar remains unexcavated. It would be fascinating to find out what was there. And a vast, vast, vast amount of Jews were killed at Beitar. They say that, the Gemara says that the reason why they figured out Bar Kokhba is not Mashiach, because he said about God, God shouldn't help us and shouldn't hinder us. You know, we'll take care of it ourselves. We don't need to have his help. And he thought one of the Tanoim, I forget which one, Elizabeth Shamua maybe, was giving his plans to the Romans in order to try and undermine the defense of Beitar, and he kicked him and he killed him.
What?
Yeah, I thought it was his uncle. Yeah, what was the name? No, it was one of the Tanoim, though.
Yeah, but
it's
done.
Yeah. Okay. So obviously it turned out Bar Kokhba was not the Mashiach that was hoped for. Beitar was destroyed. Millions of Jews, perhaps, were killed. And it says that Hadrian did not allow them to be buried for several years. They used, first of all, the blood from all the dead people to fertilize the fields for 7 years at the vineyards. And they used the dead bodies as fences. And there's a miracle which occurred that the bodies didn't rot. Until finally they were able to bury them, and they were going to bury them, and that's that point they instituted the fourth bracha in benching, Hatov HaMeitiv. Hatov HaMeitiv, God was good in that they didn't rot, and Meitiv, he did good in that he allowed them to be buried. So obviously that was a tremendous, tremendously terrible tragedy. And at that time, Jews were finally banished from Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim was turned into a Roman city. No Jews were allowed. And they built a Roman temple on the Temple Mount beforehand. after the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, it was plowed, and says it was kind of a wilderness. And that's where Rabbi Akiva was once walking in the Gemara and Makkos with the other sages, and he saw foxes in that area. But this time they built a Roman city. If you go to the Damascus Gate, Shar Shechem in Yerushalayim, you'll see a little bit to the right and below the gate, you'll see the Roman gate of the city, which is called Aelia Capitolina, if I recall correctly. That gate was, obviously the city was lower at that time, so that gate is a vestige of the Roman conquest. Okay, so we'll stop here for today, and Wednesday will be here now.
Rabbi Schwab says that, according to Rambam, Mashiach has to be a common problem.
Does not say that. Does not say that. Yechus Malachim doesn't say that. He said elsewhere Mashiach will be a common problem. But not that it's halacha they ask me to halacha.
What is it?
Oh, it's a prediction.
You guys, you haven't said that Lamana yet. One right there.
Where's the story for guys? What would you say?
That's blood.